Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Welcome to Valley Public Radio's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's special 4th of July themed show, we go to the Valley's three most iconic family-run ice cream destinations and find out what's kept them in business for a combined 230 years. We'll also talk with famed Yosemite Ranger Shelton Johnson, whose efforts to bring the once-forgotten story of the park's Buffalo Soldiers to light is attracting national attention all the way to Congress and the White House. We'll talk about race, freedom, and American culture. That's coming up in just a moment. And stay tuned, because in the second half of our program, our Rebecca Plevin will help us launch our new book club series as we talk with author Anne Fadiman, whose book, The Spirit Catches You When You Fall Down, tells the story of a Hmong immigrant family in Merced and their struggles with Western medicine and culture in the 1980s. It's a book that's now required teaching for medical students across the country. We'll find out what's changed and talk to a panel of local experts. But first, we're joined by Kern County Supervisor and Democratic Party candidate for the vacant seat in Senate District 16, Leticia Perez. Welcome to Valley Public Radio.
Thank you for the invitation. It's very nice to be here.
Before we start, I should add that we have extended a similar invitation to Ms. Perez's opponent, Republican Andy Vidak, and we hope to have him join us for a future program. I want to start out with some background for our listeners in Fresno County. They might not be as familiar with you and your name as our listeners in KPRX in Kern County. Tell us a little more about your background and your family.
Both my husband and I are from the Central Valley. We were raised here. We left to get a little education and see some of the world, but we came home back to the place where our families have been for multiple generations. So our families have been here as oil field workers. In fact, my husband's brothers, all three of them, still work in the oil fields as roughnecks. My husband was a roughneck while I was preparing for the bar, actually. So we are from the Central Valley. We've worked in the fields. We've been farmers. And so certainly appreciate and have deep, deep-rooted Central Valley values. And so we were happy to come home, because there's no place like home. And we're a little different than up north and down south, as you know, and certainly different than many parts of the country. So we feel at home here.
You also spent time in Sacramento as a staffer for Senator Rubio. Tell me about your thoughts on Sacramento, and what's the biggest problem in Sacramento from your experience on the inside?
My time with Michael Rubio was actually in the district. I was his district coordinator, so my time there was always representing Kern County, the district portion of that work. So I did not work directly out of Sacramento. However, I did consult the Senate Select Committee on Economic Development and the state permitting process. So I had the opportunity to see firsthand what I like to call the human side of business. So learning about the tremendous challenges that business and industry faces to get projects off the ground, to create jobs, and learning about those impediments really from the inside. Some of that includes CEQA reform and other permitting and regulatory matters that, though well-intended, tend to be an impediment to business, not only in a tangible sense, but remarkably in an intangible way. I think one of the most striking aspects of being a consultant to the Select Committee was in numerous conversations with industry leaders, in numerous conversations with business leaders, feeling the frustration from them in dealing with and working with the sort of Sacramento regulars, if you will. I do believe there's tends to be a disconnect between what is happening on the ground in the district, particularly the Central Valley, because we aren't Sacramento, we're not the Bay Area, we're not Los Angeles. So we tend to be not the first folks at the table, if you know what I mean. So this is a problem in terms of representation, in terms of drawing the kind of attention that we need to what does it take to really put people to work here. We have to have very specific and direct jobs plans, and ultimately need to connect the dots to put people to work.
You mentioned CEQA reform, so I'll follow up with that. This has been a big issue in California this year. Much of the effort to reform CEQA was led by Senator Rubio. Eventually, the state passed a much more modest approach to reforming the California Environmental Quality Act. What do you see as being logical, sensible reforms for CEQA? There was a lot of pushback from environmental groups, a lot of pushback in the Democratic Party about making big changes to CEQA. How do you see the role of CEQA reform being important, and what do you support there?
It's amazing to see how a piece of legislation or a great idea can really change over time and with enough complexities, really a change in nature and form. What we know about CEQA is that it's at its inception, it was intended for public works projects. It was introduced by Reagan, as you know, well intended to be a tool to protect our most pristine and valuable resources in California. What we have seen is in the following decades, a couple of things have happened. One, subsequent laws have been developed, subsequent jurisdictions, subsequent entities have been created to address environmental concerns at a much more localized level. So we have air districts, we have water boards, we have changes in the laws that have really worked better at the local level to address some of the environmental concerns that all of us have. Secondly, because the process is so complex, so expensive, and subject to potential fraud, what we have seen is abuses in the system. And so folks using CEQA to hold up development, to hold up job creation in order to meet their own personal needs. And by this, I mean folks who don't want to see, a foster home development in their neighborhood use CEQA to sue on environmental grounds, folks that don't want to see bike lanes added in San Francisco or other parts of the state. And so you can see that the law itself, if not narrowly tailored to address very specific issues, can be used as a way to stop projects and hold up even very, very good, well-intended projects. So with that said, I do believe that we need to update CEQA. I believe that we need to address the abuses because no one should be allowed to hold up projects for their own personal interests and needs. That in and of itself is unfair, it's unjust, and I believe all Californians would agree with that principle as a basic principle by which we think about policy matters and how we encourage job development, job creation. So we've got to address the abuses, the 11th hour document drop that happens through the litigation process where folks last minute, they can wait till the very last moment to come in and sue on a project with tens of thousands of documents that must be, of course, all read and reviewed. These are ways in which the system gets manipulated. And what I have found is that so many industry leaders, so many businesses will choose to develop elsewhere outside the state rather than even start the process here in California because of the fear of litigation, because of the potential of litigation and how costly and unpredictable that will be. So my sense is we've got to have a system that's fair, that's accessible, that is predictable, and that helps not only our partners in industry, but most importantly, change in our unemployment rates. Folks need to work, and if we're holding up the process unfairly and for small select groups, that should be addressed.
There's another big environmental issue out there. There were about a dozen bills in Sacramento this year that sought to regulate in some way hydraulic fracturing. This is a big issue in the San Joaquin Valley, a big issue in Kern County, of course. Environmental groups have raised all kinds of health concerns, calling for a moratorium on fracking. Those in the energy industry have been very vocal in their opposition to that effort, saying that this would hurt jobs, hurt the economy. Where do you stand on efforts to further regulate hydraulic fracturing?
In Kern County, we produce 80% of the state's oil. It's the industry that puts all three of my husband's brothers to work. It stabilizes their family, moved them into a place of tremendous hopefulness for their own children and their own families. And so I am grateful to all that the oil industry does for Kern County. We have been fracking in Kern since the 50s. We have not seen any major groundwater disruption. We have not seen problems in the environment to the degree that some people believe that we have had or some people believe that fracking will produce. Now, any major interruption like fracking into the earth has the potential for great good and great harm. And so I believe it's important that we understand the process, not have a knee-jerk reaction to just kill the industry or over-regulate it into non-existence, because we know we can do it safely, we know we can do it properly, and we do it in Kern County, and we put people to work. The creation of, or rather the discovery of the Monterey Shale has the potential to permanently turn around the economic and financial condition in Kern County. In a way that we have never seen before. But my position is that we should know what's happening, that the public has a right and access should be able to access the information as to how their environment is being affected. But I don't believe that shutting down the industry is the right way to go.
If you just joined us on Valley Public Radio today, our guest is Leticia Perez. She is a Kern County Supervisor and a Democratic Party candidate for the vacant seat in Senate District 16. Just a few days ago, we had what many are already calling a historic day with the Supreme Court overturning the Federal Defense of Marriage Act and by choosing not to rule on Prop 8, essentially affirming the earlier court's ruling on that. What was your reaction when you heard the news?
I was surprised. I had anticipated the Supreme Court would somehow get around it. There are such controversial, difficult, emotional issues that people feel very strongly about and that their emotions are tied to tradition and heritage. And I certainly appreciate that. My father's a minister. I was raised very conservative, very traditional. My husband, who's here with me today, Fernando, is also a minister. And so being from the Central Valley, we tend to be more traditional and recognize the very conservative values of the Central Valley. These are tough, tough matters. And for me personally, I tend to take a more traditional view about marriage. I certainly don't want to see the government telling churches what to do. I think churches should be autonomous in determining what is appropriate for them based on their theological guidelines. I certainly wouldn't want my father being told what to do. But I do believe there's a place for civil unions. There's a place for equality. I think discrimination against any human being is absolutely reprehensible. But as you know, these matters are complicated. And in the Central Valley, they are ones of where voters have very, very strong opinions about. And so I want to be respectful and mindful of that when we think about these particular issues. Now that the Supreme Court of the land has made a decision, I believe very strongly in the rule of law. And so we will abide by those rules and those laws and implement them at the county level and I think be better about not discriminating against people, which is good.
Construction on the high-speed rail project is scheduled to begin in just weeks, essentially. This is a huge issue in this part of the state. It's where it all begins, essentially. There are many in this area in the agricultural community that are vehemently opposed to high-speed rail, say it's going to ruin their farms, ruin their operations. Your opponent has been a big critic of high-speed rail. Where do you fall on this issue, and how can this plan be made to work for the Valley and the really diverse economy and interests that we have here?
Well, it's such a great question and a point of clear distinction between my opponent and I, as you know. He has been vehemently and adamantly opposed to high-speed rail, says he'll fight it tooth and nail. And we know that we can break ground as early as next month in high-speed rail. I think it's interesting to hear Andy talk about jobs, 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 and never once has he ever introduced a plan to create jobs, a plan to implement opportunities for people to grow in their economic interests. He simply says, I'm for jobs, 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 I hate high-speed rail, but won't say exactly what his plan is in terms of putting people to work. I think it's critical that we recognize what's coming our way. The feds have said we want to invest big money into the Central Valley in order to connect the state, in order to put California as a leader once again in many ways in the country. And they're willing to make an investment, which we know is limited only to high-speed rail. The monies match with dollars from California. But this is the biggest infrastructure project in the United States. It's the number one jobs plan, biggest jobs plan ever in California history. It can infuse the Central Valley and families here that are so desperate to work with tens of thousands of jobs. And I believe it is absolutely imperative that we connect those jobs and those economic opportunities to prosper with the populations who need it the most. We know the Central Valley is hurting. So many communities in my supervisorial district, 30 to 40% unemployment rate. In Arvin, small rural community in my supervisorial district, we have a 40% unemployment rate. We've got to address that issue head on. We've got to give people actual opportunities. And when we know that there's money coming in from the feds, opportunity to train people, opportunity to give our local community colleges, our training programs, the ability and the tools to actually give people the skills they need to take these jobs, we can absolutely turn the Central Valley around.
You mentioned double-digit unemployment throughout much of the county or throughout much of the district. You've also been supporting raising the minimum wage. How do those two things interact, and how do you feel that would address that issue?
Here's another point of distinction between Andy and myself. I've said publicly our minimum wage hasn't been raised since 2008. We know throughout the Central Valley, we have single moms and students who are dealing with record increases in costs of gasoline and costs of rent and costs of tuition. To even be a student now seems virtually impossible unless you have another outside source paying for your education. Education used to be accessible, affordable, and one of the great prides of California. And yet we see these record and soaring increases without the corresponding increases in wages. What we know about our surrounding states, Washington, Oregon, and we look at them closely, we look at their minimum wage, and we see that it's higher than ours, and we see that they have lower unemployment rates. So this accusation by Andy that if we raise minimum wage, all the businesses are going to flood out of California into neighboring states is simply not true. It isn't warranted. It isn't founded. It doesn't bear out in evidence. We know that if that were true for our surrounding states and they were really most interested in the lowest minimum wage possible, they'd come into California. But it's not what we see. We see lower unemployment rates. We see local businesses prospering and thriving because when people have money in their pocket, they spend it. We know that folks that make minimum wage, even a small increase to $8.25 or $8.50 or $9, would put just a little more money in their pocket to meet those unmet needs that they're not able to meet at minimum wage. And we know they spend it right here, right now, in our local communities and help our local economies thrive. It's a good thing. It's good to encourage people to work, to give people a sense of hope that they're not going to slave away at $8 an hour for the rest of their lives, but that if you work hard, which we all should do, and we're responsible for passing that work ethic down to our children, that there should be a reward for that behavior.
Our guest today has been Leticia Perez. She is Kern County Supervisor and Democratic Party candidate for the vacant seat in Senate District 16, the special election July 23rd. Ms. Perez, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. The 4th of July is practically synonymous with hot weather and cool treats. This week, many Central California residents will celebrate Independence Day with a visit to their favorite ice cream shop. Valley Public Radio's Rebecca Plevin and Ezra Romero teamed up to look at three ice cream shops as part of our series Summer Scoop, shops that have remained popular and successful across generations.
The summer's just started, and we've already eaten a lot of ice cream.
We've tasted ice cream up and down the San Joaquin Valley.
We're practically ice cream experts.
Sort of, Rebecca. For this story, we visited three iconic ice cream shops in the region.
I checked out Reimer's Candies and Gifts in the mountain community of Three Rivers near Sequoia National Park.
And I visited Superior Dairy in Hanford and DeWar's Candy in Bakersfield.
But we weren't there just to eat. We were also on the lookout for what has allowed these legacy ice cream shops to stand the test of time.
Dr. William Rice is a real ice cream expert. He's a Fresno State professor who has researched the marketing of the ice cream industry in the Valley. He says those three shops stand out for their own reasons.
One up in Three Rivers is more of what I call the hangout. It's the identification type of location. The one in Hanford has to do with family experiences and let your family come and have something that, you know, your family did 25 years ago.
Let's first talk about location. Reimer's opened more than 50 years ago in Three Rivers. Today, it's owned by the Bretz family, who bought the ice cream and chocolate shop 8 years ago. Mary Ann Bretz says the company's locations contribute to its success. The original shop looks like a mountain house in the Swiss Alps. Customers can enjoy their ice cream while sitting in Adirondack chairs overlooking the river and watching whitewater rafters float by.
Our concept is to be a beautiful little candy and ice cream store in beautiful places. So it's that gingerbread house that you find after a walk in the woods.
The company's newer stores are in Avila Beach on the Central Coast and in Oakhurst near Yosemite National Park.
I have to say that I think that's why the ice cream tastes so good in our stores, because it's found in such beautiful places.
I talked to Sergio Moreno of Visalia. He says visiting Reimer's is like a mini getaway.
Why do you all like to come up here?
To get out of town, and it's nice, and the ice cream is great.
Last week, he sat outside the shop with his wife and two kids and licked a cone of coffee and Almond Joy ice cream.
Well, it's kind of like it's old and it's like Western. It's like, you know, in the mountains and stuff.
But Reimer's offers more than ice cream with a view. The shop's location also influences its flavors.
Our Three Rivers and our Sierra Wild Blackberry has blackberries that grow along the rivers here in Three Rivers. Our walnuts are all from the Central Valley. The peaches in our peaches and cream actually grow on my peach tree.
Location is also key for Superior Dairy in Hanford. The 84-year-old ice cream parlor is located in the heart of downtown Hanford and sits across the street from the library and a carousel. People travel on Amtrak from Fresno and Bakersfield to get there. Susan Wing is a co-owner and president of Superior Dairy.
When they come off the train to Hanford, they're coming here. They're coming to get their ice cream, and then they visit and go through downtown, too. So it's good for everybody in Hanford.
Traditions like that have been passed down through generations.
Which brings us to our second point, community connection. Dr. Rice says the longer a scoop shop has been in a community, the deeper the connection is.
And I think all three of them have longevity and have connectivity because those roots are back before you had an onslaught of all the specialty ice cream places today, which are, you know, too fast, too cut and dried, too sterile.
Wing says customers continue to come to Superior Dairy to reconnect with childhood memories and pleasure.
People feel it'll always be here, and they know they can come back and get the same gigantic thing they got before. It's going to taste the same. It's going to look the same.
When you walk into Superior Dairy, you step back in time. The ceilings are tin pressed, the booths are gumball colored, and the scoops are enormous. Bailey Lyles visits Superior Dairy once a week with her brother and her best friend. She orders a single monstrous scoop of chocolate ice cream with hot fudge on the side and peanut butter sauce on top. She says Hanford wouldn't be the same without Superior Dairy.
This is the thing that makes Hanford famous and throughout California. Everybody knows Superior Dairy.
Many customers, like Rod Parmley of Pebble Beach, say the same thing about DeWars and Bakersfield.
Places like this give you a good feeling that you can't gain at other places because it's just like a piece of home.
One reason the shops might feel like home, they've been in the DeWar family for generations.
I spoke with Peter Johnson, director of the Institute for Family Business at the University of the Pacific in Stockton. He says family-owned businesses can be successful because the owners, relatives, and children are all dedicated to upholding the family's legacies.
When their name's up on the wall, it gives them a sense of pride and there's a passion around that.
And that's what DeWars embodies. The family-owned business, which is more than 100 years old, is known for its ice cream.
Very few family-owned businesses like this anymore on the planet because they just get beat down.
Johnson says the recipe for success is maintaining the family's values, even if the business grows or adds new products.
You may start to offer low-fat types of ice creams or, you know, whatever the trendy things are. But those core values, those things that you're passionate about as a family, you know, those kinds of values help families be successful year after year and generation after generation.
Bakersfield resident George Palmer says that is exactly what DeWars has done.
I think we're very fortunate that this family has held it together and has expanded and does an excellent business.
So, Ezra, a long, hot holiday weekend is approaching, and there are so many local ice cream options. Where are you going to go for a scoop?
I don't know yet, but I'm sure I'll have a sweet story to tell. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
And I'm Rebecca Plevin.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. You can go to our website and check out all of the reports, blogs, photo galleries, and more from our Scoop 89 series, Summer Scoop, and also share your favorite ice cream memories again on our website, kvpr.org. And stay tuned. Our 4th of July theme program continues in just a moment with famed Yosemite Ranger Shelton Johnson, who's working to bring the story of the Buffalo Soldiers in Yosemite to light. It's attracting attention all the way to President Obama and in Congress. That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. 100 years ago this summer, a group of U.S. Army cavalry soldiers left the Presidio in San Francisco and made the hot, dusty trek across the San Joaquin Valley to both Yosemite and Sequoia National Parks. Veterans of the Spanish-American War, they were charged with protecting the new national parks from poachers and timber thieves and in building park infrastructure. They were, in essence, America's first park rangers. But the members of the 9th and 10th Cavalry weren't ordinary troops. They were African Americans, members of four segregated regiments known as Buffalo Soldiers. For years, their role in the park's early history was largely forgotten. But thanks to the work of Yosemite Ranger Shelton Johnson, their stories are now being told and are the focus of a new national campaign that extends all the way to Congress and President Obama. Every Sunday night at the Yosemite Theater, Johnson dons the woolen uniform of one of those Buffalo Soldiers and takes park visitors back in time.
My name is Sergeant Elise Bowman, Troop K, 9th Regiment of Cavalry.
The park's only African-American ranger, Johnson has dedicated his career to telling the stories of those early African-Americans who played a critical role during the early days of the parks.
How many of you are troubled by that information that there are colored soldiers, armed colored soldiers, patrolling Yosemite? You should be. If you knew us a little bit better, you'd be troubled.
It's a living history role that's earned him national awards and attention, including features on Oprah Winfrey's talk show and in the Ken Burns documentary, The National Parks. A few days ago, after the fans and autograph seekers had left the theater, I sat down with Johnson to talk about his work and about the legacy of the Buffalo Soldiers.
There's nothing more powerful than hearing the story of people who look like you, who sound like you. And so for African Americans, hearing that some of the first National Park Rangers were these Buffalo Soldiers, that's an incredibly powerful story because it contradicts the mindset that many people have, including African Americans, that the National Parks, it's not a black thing. It's not something that black people do.
According to Johnson, African Americans make up just 1% of Yosemite's total attendance. He hopes stories like this one help change that.
If they had visited the park 100 years ago, they would have found people that looked just like them in a stewardship role, in a protective role of this place that's celebrated throughout the world.
The Buffalo Soldiers served in Yosemite and Sequoia National Parks between 1891 and 1913. They built what is considered the first museum in a national park, built the first usable road to the giant forest in Sequoia, and the first trail to the top of Mount Whitney. But somehow, their story faded away. Then one day in 2001, Johnson was working in the Yosemite Research Library and came across an old photo of black soldiers on horseback in Yosemite. He knew then his life was about to change.
It was electric. It was excitement to find that I had the responsibility to communicate this history. Most interpreters rarely have the opportunity to literally tell a story that hasn't really been told before. It's an interpreter's dream. It's a storyteller's dream to find a significant story, a nationally significant story, a globally significant story. And when people ask, well, how is it globally significant? I said, well, if you're a scholar of the diaspora, the spread of African peoples throughout the world, you would recognize that these Buffalo Soldiers were in the vanguard of race relations in the latter half of the 19th century. As Booker T. Washington, I think, referred to them, he basically said they were standard bearers of the race. If you were a Buffalo Soldier in 1900, you were the epitome. You were it. You know, people, they modeled themselves after, they envied you, because there were so few jobs that had any measure of respect to them. They were mostly servile. They were mostly, you're out there in the field and you were a laborer of some kind. And so to wear the uniform of the United States government and to be in a situation where you might sacrifice your own life for your country that had not really extended its hand to you, that's a very powerful thing.
So who were the Buffalo Soldiers? Johnson says they not only shared similar backgrounds, but also similar attitudes and views on race and society.
These men were the sons and grandsons of sharecroppers and prior to that, enslaved people. They were brought up to look at white folks in a completely different way, and their relationship with them was much more obviously subservient. But, you know, the folks that became soldiers, as I say in my play, were never the servile or servient type. They were men that literally would have been killed if they had stayed in the South. So they joined the military for the safekeeping of being in the Army, surrounded by men who had a similar sort of mindset, a similar sort of sense of self, that they were important and deserved better.
He says their story is even more remarkable given the times in which they lived.
when they were here, imagine a time when an African American is being lynched on a daily basis in the South, and that these men have been brought up in that social milieu, brought up in that cultural climate, that cultural environment, and yet they had to tell people who were European American what they could or could not do. And how do you do that without offending someone when you're within a world that does not see you in any sort of authoritative role? But they had to do it. That was the job. So it was a combination of being a warrior at the same time of being someone who understands the value of diplomacy. They were diplomats. They had to have this edge to them, but they also had to have this flexibility to themselves as well, because they were walking on a tightrope, literally.
Johnson's stage play and novel have helped make him something of a National Parks celebrity. After appearing before millions of viewers on Oprah 3 years ago, he's now working on a film project of his own. But he says it's the story, not the fame, that he's after.
And the thing that I found about the nature of history is that it can be very fragile. So I'm due to retire in 7 years. If I stop giving my program, then the history is no longer told in the place where it took place, which means the story will disappear. Now, yes, it's in exhibits. Yes, it's in the Ken Burns film. You know, it was on Oprah talked about it. That's all great. But I have to do everything in my power to assure that the history lives beyond me.
Fortunately, Johnson is not alone, and his efforts to share the story beyond Yosemite are paying off. Earlier this year, President Obama created the Charles Young Buffalo Soldiers National Monument in Ohio. It honors the commander of one of the Yosemite regiments, who served as the first black park superintendent and the highest-ranking African-American in the military. There's also a bill in Congress that would study the creation of a new national trail to honor the soldiers by tracing the route they took through the Central Valley to the parks.
What we're talking about is recognition for those who were heretofore invisible. And it's always a powerful thing to move from invisibility to visibility.
And this July 4th weekend, when Americans celebrate freedom and independence, Ranger Johnson says that all Americans can find inspiration in both this story and in the wonders of the national parks.
Essentially, the Buffalo Soldier story is all about freedom. And national parks are all about freedom. And when you're in a national park, freedom is tangible. Freedom is something that is atmospheric. Freedom is something that the light is filtering through. Freedom is something that's in three dimensions. It's sight, sound, hearing, it's tactile, it's olfactory. All of those things are around you when you're in a national park. So freedom becomes something that you can put around you like a good suit of clothes.
You can see Shelton Johnson perform as Sergeant Elize Bowman every Sunday night at the Yosemite Theater at 7 p.m. His book, Glory Land, is published by Sierra Club Books. His film is expected to air on public television stations later this year. For Valley Public Radio and Valley Edition, I'm Joe Moore. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. I'm Joe Moore. Today we officially launch a new reoccurring segment on our program called Homegrown, a public radio virtual book club. Every few months we'll select a new book that is in some way about Central California, invite you to read along at home, and then a few weeks later we'll invite the author to join us for a discussion about the book. Today we're talking about a book by Ann Fadiman called The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. It tells the story of a clash of cultures between a Hmong immigrant family and the Western medical tradition in Merced in the 1980s. We'll be joined by a diverse panel of experts to talk about the book in a few moments. But first, a few days ago, FM 89's Rebecca Plevin talked with author Ann Fadiman to get her thoughts on the reaction to the book, which is now taught in medical schools across the country, and about what's changed in the past 25 years.
How did you first learn about Leah Lee and her story?
I learned about not so much Leah in particular, but the conflicts between Hmong patients and their doctors at the county hospital in Merced from an old college friend of mine named Bill Selvage, who at that time, we're talking late 80s, was the chief resident in family practice at the hospital. He said that there had been a number of cultural conflicts between Hmong patients and their caregivers, and I thought that I might get an interesting magazine article out of it. It was not until I actually arrived in Merced that I heard about Leah in particular.
What about her story grabbed you?
Her family had been so well-intentioned, and her doctors had been so well-intentioned. It was clear right at the start that this was not a story with villains. Leah was a little girl with a seizure disorder, and her doctors had been excellent doctors, a pair of married pediatricians who would have been my kids' pediatricians later on when I had kids if I lived in Merced, just wonderful people, but who didn't have a cultural understanding that might have enabled them to get through to Leah's parents, who were analogously exceptional parents, smart, devoted, just wonderful parents, but who failed to give Leah her seizure meds as prescribed for a variety of reasons. And the case had ended tragically, first with Leah being removed from her family and sent to a foster home so that she could be given her meds, and then after she came back to live with her family, having a neurological crisis that was not her parents' fault that left her in a vegetative state. So it was a story with tragedy and drama in which the villain was cultural misunderstanding rather than obtuseness or laziness or cruelty or any other lack of virtue on the part of any of the characters. And as a writer, I was fascinated by the challenge of telling a story that ended badly and yet had no villains.
Right, absolutely. There's no bad doctor here. There's no negligent parents.
Yeah. That's right.
When you first came to Merced, what were your first impressions?
Well, the city was very important, both as a setting, a very improbable setting, because at that time there were more than 10,000 Hmong refugees and their children living in Merced. It was about one out of every six people living in Merced was Hmong at that time, and that was an amazing statistic. There were other places in the country, including Fresno and St. Paul, Minnesota, that had larger Hmong populations, but there was no other place in which the Hmong constituted a larger fraction of the population. So they had really impacted the town. When I went there, I had no idea what an incredibly rich Hmong community I was going to find. But it was also a community that had caused some problematic economic impact on the town of Merced. The Hmong were, without a doubt, an economic burden at that time. At the same time, the Hmong contributed an enormous amount culturally to the town. I might note, though, that the Hmong had at that time relatively high welfare rates because they had to come to the United States without education or knowledge of the English language because of our meddling in their country during the Vietnam War. They were not economic migrants. They had not chosen to come to the United States in order to find jobs or do better economically or get education for their children. They didn't want to be here. The Hmong, because they had collaborated with the U.S., became targets of genocide, and tens of thousands fled on foot to refugee camps in Thailand, and the majority ended up in the United States. So in my view, we owed them.
You mentioned the large percentage of the population that was Hmong and some of the economic issues they posed to the city. How did you see this play out in the hospital there?
Well, the hospital was swamped with Hmong patients who didn't really want to be there during a time when interpreting was not legally mandated and there were no funds for interpreting. So there's only one Hmong interpreter. She was there for an eight-hour shift. The rest of the time, interpreting was done by family members or by the hospital janitor. It was not uncommon for 10-year-old boys who spoke English because they had learned English in American schools to have to interpret extremely medically delicate conversations about, you know, whether their mothers should have an immediate emergency C-section in the maternity ward. Really, really difficult, inappropriate, problematic issues. And the Hmong were quite suspicious of American medicine, so they often would not come to the hospital until they were really very sick. And, of course, those cases were likely to have less good outcomes than if they had come a little bit earlier, and that did not help the reputation of American medicine in the Hmong community. So they had a reputation at the hospital as being problematic patients, and I could see why, although I first went out to Merced in 1988. So you have to remember that things have changed radically
since the period that my book was about. And although the book has dates on virtually every single page, it drives me crazy when some readers, you know, appear to be wearing special glasses that make them unable to see those dates and seem to assume that Hmong culture is frozen in time, and if they meet a Hmong American now, he's going to be exactly like, let's say, Nau Khao Li, Leah's father. Of course, decades have gone by, and of course, things have changed a great deal.
And that does lead me to my next question. I was going to ask if you have been back to the Valley, and if so, what you've noticed has changed or evolved at hospitals in terms of medical care in these communities.
I've been back several times. Most recently, a little over a year ago, and the changes are entirely positive. Rather surprisingly, this small county hospital has become internationally known as a model of exemplary cross-cultural care. They have a program to train Hmong shamans in the ways of Western medicine. They bring them to every department. Once they are familiar with the hospital, they are issued badges and they're allowed to come into the hospital and perform certain rituals just as if they were Catholic priests or Protestant ministers. They showed me a bed in the ER and said proudly that a shaman had just recently been there and had performed a ritual at the bedside. I could not imagine that having happened in 1988 when I was first in Merced. Most signs in the hospital are in English, Spanish, and Hmong. They have a very good interpreting system now. Back then, there were hardly any Hmong adults in town who spoke English, and there were no American adults in town who spoke Hmong. So I was really impressed at the changes that had been made at the hospital. They're trying extremely hard to be cross-culturally sensitive.
I was wondering if you're surprised that the story has resonated so far. I mean, here you had one young girl's story in this small community in a rural part of California. Are you surprised that this book is now read, you know, in medical schools across the country and that it really had so much impact?
Yes. I have never ceased being surprised. I spent almost 9 years writing this book, and there were times during that period when I really thought I was a lunatic, because who was going to want to read a book about an epileptic Hmong toddler? But I think that the book has ended up resonating because people are interested in cross-cultural issues, they're interested in medical issues, and I also think that Leah's family and her doctors are compelling people. Her family are wonderful people. I really learned how to be a mother from Leah's mother. Leah was the 14th child in the family. Not all the children had survived. It was a huge family, and there were children of all different ages, and I could see, gee, if you treat a baby like this, how will that baby be at 2 and 4 and 7 and 10 and 18? And even though Leah's mother legally had been declared by my culture to be a negligent mother, she had to be declared a negligent mother because she hadn't given Leah her meds in order for Leah to be removed to foster care, I felt that she was the best mother I had ever met. And I spent so many hours watching her mother, Leah, and her other kids. She taught me so much about how to be a good mother. And I think that perhaps the sense that the book gave of being inside this family that originally seemed strange, readers might originally say, oh, gosh, you know, the Hmong, where are they from? And, oh, do they really sacrifice animals? And do they really do this? And do they really do that? And they really did do all those things, and yet they weren't strange at all. So I think that maybe it was the making the strange familiar that made the book resonate. I think people cared about Leah because she was someone worth caring about.
And I guess my last question, Anne, I'm really interested to know, have you maintained connection with the Lee family?
The last time I saw the family was an enormously sad occasion. A little less than a year ago, Leah finally died at the age of 30. She'd been in a vegetative state since the age of 4, and I'd just like to point out how extraordinary extraordinary it is that her family was able to keep her alive at home, never institutionalizing her for that long. It's a truly a medical miracle, and I think can only be explained by her family's love. Nothing else could possibly have kept her alive for that long. But she finally did die of pneumonia at the end of last August. And I, of course, went out to her funeral in Sacramento in September, a three-day funeral. And it was heartbreaking, but beautiful to spend time with everyone in the family. The whole community was there. Leah was buried fairly close by, so her family can visit her often. One of her sisters wrote me recently that she'd gone to the grave with her kids and had brought, I think that they brought hamburgers from a local fast food restaurant because they had felt sad that Leah, their Auntie Leah, had not been able to eat because, of course, Leah had to be fed, either bottle-fed or fed with a tube, and since the age of four had never been able to eat anything solid. I loved the thought of these bags of hamburgers being left for her spirit as a form of consolation. I might also mention that her siblings have been very successful. Most of them have graduated from college. The reception was held at the very nice home of her brother, Chang, who's a dental assistant. Many of her siblings have married and have kids. The kids are gorgeous and well-behaved and just always so much fun to be around. It was wonderful for me to see the next generation moving forward. But many readers wrote to me and said, gosh, Leah must have been such a burden. Is it better for the family without her? And the answer is no. I can never explain the role that Leah served in that family. 26 years in a vegetative state, she was so hard to take care of, but she was so loved. And she was the kind of gravitational center around which the family orbited. So I'm not sure that the family, even though it's certainly a loving and very functional family, I'm not sure they'll ever recover from her death. And it's impossible to explain unless you've been in that living room with the family when she was alive and seen the love radiating from everyone in her direction.
Our guest today has been Anne Fadiman, author of the book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us here at Valley Public Radio.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. It's been a great pleasure.
Fascinating conversation, Rebecca. Thank you so much. Rebecca Plevin joins us now in our studio to host a roundtable discussion about this book, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. With this talk with author Anne Fadiman, we have some folks who have direct involvement in this story and in the Merced community joining us now, Rebecca.
That's right. So joining us in the studio now is Candace Adam-Medefin. She's the executive director of Healthy House Within a Match Coalition in Merced. Hi, Candace.
Hi.
And also joining us on the phone is Dr. Jim McDermid from the Merced Family Medicine Residency Program and Dr. Michael Tao, who recently became the first Hmong psychiatrist to graduate from UCSF Fresno. And so, Jim, I want to start with you. I know you're very familiar with the doctors and medical challenges featured in The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. What was your reaction when you first read this book? And I'm wondering what stood out to you.
I think the thing that Anne Fadiman was able to do was able to present a balanced view. So she was able to give the Hmong point of view, the Lee family point of view, as well as the Western doctor's point of view in a balanced way. She didn't take sides. She just presented the facts and allowed the reader to decide for themselves what viewpoints they developed after reading the book.
Great. And Michael, I want to ask you the same question. You've told me that you told me that you've read this book several times, and I'm wondering if you could describe how your reaction to this book has evolved as you've read it.
Yeah. You know, as I told you before, the first time I read it was in high school. And at that time, you know, as a teenager growing up with parents who are refugees, there was even a cultural difference between myself and my parents. And just reading about anything that related, you know, about cultural differences and cultural barriers was just so interesting at that point in my life. Since then, in medical school, I've read it as well, and even in undergrad in the anthropology class, I've also read it. And over time, I started to see different reactions from, you know, my colleagues, my classmates, and my opinion on it, you know, has evolved somewhat in that there is a risk that comes with trying to use this book as to educate others about the Hmong community, in that there's a fine line between stereotyping and trying to teach others about a different culture.
Absolutely. And do you think that, does this book sort of skirt that fine line, or does it, how does it do on that?
Well, I think it's the difficulty is that, well, I think Ann Fadiman does a good job in trying not to pick sides, but the Hmong community and the culture in the Hmong community is so heterogeneous that just using this one book only provides one viewpoint.
Okay, great. And Candace, your organization does a lot of work today related to cultural sensitivity and cultural competency in medical care. And I'm wondering if you could describe how this book has influenced your organization's work and maybe what lessons you and your organization have drawn from this.
Well, the book certainly has shown kind of the holistic view of health that Hmong culture has. You never treat a physical illness without addressing the spiritual side of it. And it's really helped us understand what a high-context culture is, a culture where Hmong is a high-context language, too. So it's a language similar to what identical twins in our culture might communicate with, where they could say one word and it means a whole host of things, the tone, the people there, the context in which it's said, the gestures, the eye contact, all of that is part of the communication. So it's helped us as an agency that provides medical interpreters to train our interpreters to be cultural mediators, to be able to read all those nonverbal cues, which make up 70% of communication, and to be sure that we can culturally adapt medical messages appropriately for patients.
Okay, great. And turning back to you, Jim, I want to ask how relevant is this book today? And I'm wondering if you think medical care in the Valley has become more culturally sensitive or has changed since this book was published in the late 1990s.
Well, it certainly has changed. We have fewer cultural conflicts, but that's really due thanks to some of the not only medical, trained medical interpreters who come from Healthy House, but also when they act as cultural brokers to interpret not only the language, but also the culture. So that's made a huge difference, and that took a long time. But the other point of view that I would like to get across is the difference in the point of view of Western medicine, where little Leah would have what we would refer to as tonic-clonic seizures due to electrical activity in the neurons of her brain being uncontrolled, versus the Hmong point of view or the Lee's point of view. Their perspective was quadapay, meaning the spirit catches you and you fall down and then you have the seizures, which was really due to soul loss. And that was because Leah's sister slammed the door and caused Leah's soul to be frightened out of her body. So instead of anticonvulsant medication, they really believed that she needed a shaman to go off into the spirit world to negotiate for the return of her lost soul to bring it back to her body. So those are, you know, dramatically different perspectives.
Absolutely, and that can help us understand why there would be such different perspectives on the proper way to treat her and her condition. And Michael, I want to ask you that too, from your experience as the son of Hmong refugees and also as a doctor now, how relevant do you think this book is today?
Michael? Well, I think it's, for me, that's a difficult question. I don't have the experience, and I can't really say how things were back in the 80s, because that's when I was born. I do think things are probably better now. Although I must say that there are still definite cultural barriers, and that is why cultural competency has been emphasized in medical schools and in hospitals, because we know that that's important in order to provide good care.
Dr. Tao, Joe Moore here from Valley Public Radio. I have a question for you, and again, it's about the response to this book. And there's so few opportunities or so few books or other publications that have talked about the Hmong people on a national level. And what are your thoughts as far as how the overall cultural awareness of the Hmong in the general public beyond just the medical profession? Has this book been a positive force in that regard? You talked about the Hmong community is very heterogeneous. Are there other opportunities to try to build on what the exposure that this book has provided to raise awareness about who are the Hmong people amongst a general audience and awareness of the complexities of these cultural differences?
It's up and coming. Here in Fresno in April, there was actually the Hmong National Conference, which is held biannually. And one of the workshops was Beyond the Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. And they talked about the implications of the book and what we need to do to go beyond it and to move the community forward. Because, you know, the opinion is that, well, this book only provided one point of view, and there's, you know, the Hmong community is so heterogeneous. For example, you know, probably about half are Catholic and Christian, and they do not practice any traditional, rituals, and that's just not, illustrated in the book.
Fascinating.
Great. And Candace, I wanted to ask you another question. Are you surprised this book has resonated so far beyond the Valley? I know that I threw that question out to Ann Fadiman as well, but are you surprised that this book has resonated so far beyond our region and left such an impact?
Well, I don't know if I'm surprised, but I'm certainly pleased it has. I know that I think it's impacted healthcare in so many significant ways. I mean, even the whole attention given to the social determinants of health now, I don't know if you've heard that, but it's this whole notion that our socioeconomic, you know, characteristics, which is our context, has a lot more to do with our lifespan, our, you know, susceptibility to certain illnesses, et cetera, than we ever, as Americans, as radical individuals, would want to admit. You know, we're not in control of everything. And also in the mental health system, we're seeing a big movement called Culture Cures, which is the whole notion that especially dealing with many cultural populations like we do here in the Central Valley, we need to be very attuned to all the cultural characteristics of people with mental illness, including their religion, their cultural traditions, their diets, everything, to help them find their way back to mental health. So it's had really significant impact. Obviously, there are still a lot of systemic problems in the healthcare system. Young residents who want to practice culturally responsive techniques find themselves constrained by time and by, you know, lack of time and lack of money. That's always a threat to cultural programs.
We have time for about one more question.
Okay, great. I guess I'll throw this out to both Jim and then Michael, whoever wants to answer this question. But what do you think doctors can do today to still be more culturally sensitive to situations like this?
Well, this is Jim McDiarmid. One thing I think we can do, and that it sort of backs up what Candace was saying, is that the constraints of time. Because if physicians did take the time to ask the patients, what do you call the problem? You know, what do you think caused this problem? You know, have you tried anything that has helped this sickness? And, of course, doctors are under constraints of time, and so they're forced to kind of jump in, find out what the symptom is, try to treat it, and go on to the next patient. Whereas to be really culturally responsive, we need to have that extra time, not only to use a trained medical interpreter, but to get into the underlying reasons why the patient thinks they have this problem.
And Michael?
I think education has to play a big role. And I think the overall concept, when I think of cultural competency, is not that we need to learn details about other cultures. It's actually being able to recognize that medicine is and there's a culture of medicine within itself. And to know that and to be able to negotiate that with different cultures.
Fascinating discussion, and I'm sure it will continue. Dr. Michael Tao, the recent graduate of UCSF Fresno and the first Hmong psychiatrist graduate from that program, thank you so much for joining us. Also, Dr. Jim McDermott from the Merced Family Medicine Residency Program, thank you for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
And Candace Adam-Medefin, the Executive Director of Healthy House Within a Match Coalition in Merced, thanks for stopping by today.
Thank you for having me.
Our next book in this series, Rebecca, is what?
Is Wild by Cheryl Strayed. It's about a woman who hikes the Pacific Crest Trail solo.
Very exciting. We'll have that in a few weeks on our program, Valley Edition. That's all for today's program. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org. And again, if you just joined us, the book we've been talking about is by author Ann Fadiman. It's called The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and reporter Rebecca Plevin, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians on the web at chcf.org.